File 20.
Several volumes would be needed if one were to give an adequate account of the whole procedure and fully describe all its hollow fallacies. But if we pass over the details and look at the product itself while it is in operation, I think this alone will be sufficient to open the eyes of even the most innocent and credulous person, so that he may recognize the absurdity of this institution by looking at it objectively. In order to realize how this human aberration is as harmful as it is absurd, the test and easiest method is to compare democratic parliamentarianism with a genuine German democracy. The remarkable characteristic of the parliamentary form of democracy is the fact that a number of persons, let us say 500, including in recent time women also, are elected to Parliament and invested with authority to give final judgment on anything and everything. In practice, they alone are the governing body, for although they may appoint a cabinet, which seems outwardly to direct the affairs of state, this cabinet has not a real existence of its own. In reality, the so-called government cannot do anything against the will of the assembly. It can never be called to account for anything, since the right of decision is not vested in the cabinet, but in the parliamentary majority. The cabinet always functions only as the executor of the will of the majority. Its political ability can be judged only according to how far it succeeds in adjusting itself to the will of the majority, or in persuading the majority to agree to its proposals. But this means that it must descend from the level of a real governing power to that of a mendicant who has to beg the approval of a majority that may be got together for the time being. Indeed, the chief preoccupation of the cabinet must be to secure for itself, in the case of each individual measure, the favour of the majority then in power, or, failing that, to form a new majority that will be more favourably disposed. If it should succeed in either of these efforts, it may go on governing for a little while. If it should fail to win or form a majority, it must retire. The question whether its policy as such has been right or wrong does not matter at all. Thereby, all responsibility is abolished in practice. To what consequences such a state of affairs can lead may easily be understood from the following simple considerations. Those 500 deputies who have been elected by the people come from various dissimilar callings in life and show very varying degrees of political capacity, with the result that the whole combination is disjointed and sometimes presents quite a sorry picture. Surely nobody believes that these chosen representatives of the nation are the choice spirits or first-class intellects. Nobody, I hope, is foolish enough to pretend that hundreds of statesmen can emerge from papers placed in the ballot box by electors who are anything else but averagely intelligent. The absurd notion that men of genius are born out of universal suffrage cannot be too strongly repudiated. In the first place, those times may be really called blessed when one genuine statesman makes his appearance among a people. Such statesmen do not appear all at once in hundreds or more. Secondly, among the broad masses, there is instinctively a definite antipathy towards every outstanding genius. There is a better chance of seeing a camel pass through the eye of a needle than of seeing a really great man discovered through an election. Whatever has happened in history above the level of the average of the broad public has mostly been due to the driving force of an individual personality. But here, 500 persons of less than modest intellectual qualities pass judgment on the most important problems affecting the nation. They form governments which in turn learn to win the approval of the illustrious assembly for every legislative step that may be taken, which means that the policy to be carried out is actually the policy of the 500. And indeed, generally speaking, the policy bears the stamp of its origin. But let us pass over the intellectual qualities of these representatives and ask what is the nature of the task set before them. If we consider the fact that the problems which have to be discussed and solved belong to the most varied and diverse fields, we can very well realize how inefficient a governing system must be which entrusts the right of decision to a mass assembly, in which only very few possess the knowledge and experience such as would qualify them to deal with the matters that have to be settled. The most important economic measures are submitted to a tribunal, in which not more than one-tenth of the members have studied the elements of economics. This means that the final authority is vested in men who are utterly devoid of any preparatory training which might make them competent to decide on the questions at issue. The same holds true of every other problem. It is always a majority of ignorant and incompetent people who decide on each measure. For the composition of the institution does not vary, while the problems to be dealt with come from the most varied spheres of public life. An intelligent judgment would be possible only if different deputies had the authority to deal with different issues. It is out of the question to think that the same people are fitted to decide on transport questions as well as, let us say, on questions of foreign policy, unless each of them be a universal genius. But scarcely more than one genius appears in a century. Here we are scarcely ever dealing with real brains, but only with dilettanti who are as narrow-minded as they are conceited and arrogant, intellectual demi-mondes of the worst kind. This is why these honourable gentlemen show such astonishing levity in discussing and deciding on matters that would demand the most painstaking consideration, even from great minds. Measures of momentous importance for the future existence of the state are framed and discussed in an atmosphere more suited to the card table. Indeed, the latter suggests a much more fitting occupation for these gentlemen than that of deciding the destinies of a people. Of course, it would be unfair to assume that each member in such a parliament was endowed by nature with such a small sense of responsibility. That is out of the question. But this system, by forcing the individual to pass judgment on questions for which he is not competent, gradually debases his moral character. Nobody will have the courage to say, "Gentlemen, I am afraid we know nothing about what we are talking about. I, for one, have no competency in the matter at all." Anyhow, if such a declaration were made, it would not change matters very much, for such outspoken honesty would not be understood. The person who made the declaration would be deemed an honourable ass, who ought not to be allowed to spoil the game. Those who have a knowledge of human nature know that nobody likes to be considered a fool among his associates, and in certain circles honesty is taken as an index of stupidity. Thus it happens that a naturally upright man, once he finds himself elected to Parliament, may eventually be induced by the force of circumstance to acquiesce in a general line of conduct which is base in itself and amounts to a betrayal of the public trust. That feeling that if the individual refrained from taking part in a certain decision, his attitude would not alter the situation in the least, destroys every real sense of honour which might occasionally arouse the conscience of one person or another. Finally, the otherwise upright deputy will succeed in persuading himself that he is by no means the worst of the lot, and that by taking part in a certain line of action he may prevent something worse from happening. A counter-argument may be put forward here. It may be said that, of course, the individual member may not have the knowledge which is requisite for the treatment of this or that question, yet his attitude towards it is taken on the advice of his party as the guiding authority in each political matter. And it may be further said that the party sets up special committees of experts who have even more than the requisite knowledge for dealing with the questions placed before them. At first sight, that argument seems sound, but then another question arises, namely, why are 500 persons elected if only a few have the wisdom which is required to deal with the more important problems? It is not the aim of our modern democratic parliamentary system to bring together an assembly of intelligent and well-informed deputies. Not at all. The aim, rather, is to bring together a group of non-entities who are dependent upon others for their views and who can be all the more easily led, the narrower the mental outlook of each individual is. That is the only way in which a party policy, according to the evil meaning it has today, can be put into effect. And by this method alone, it is possible for the wire-puller, who exercises the real control, to remain in the dark, so that personally he can never be brought to account for his actions. For under such circumstances, none of the decisions taken, no matter how disastrous they may turn out for the nation as a whole, can be laid at the door of the individual whom everybody knows to be the evil genius responsible for the whole affair. All responsibility is shifted to the shoulders of the party as a whole. In practice, no actual responsibility remains. For responsibility arises only from personal duty, and not from the obligations that rest with a parliamentary assembly of empty talkers. The parliamentary institution attracts people of the badger type, who do not like the open light. No upright man who is ready to accept personal responsibility for his acts will be attracted to such an institution. That is the reason why this brand of democracy has become a tool in the hand of that race which, because of the inner purposes it wishes to attain, must shun the open light, as it has always done and always will do. Only a Jew can praise an institution which is corrupt and false as himself. As a contrast to this kind of democracy, we have the German democracy, which is a true democracy. For here The leader is freely chosen and is obliged to accept full responsibility for all his actions and omissions. The problems to be dealt with are not put to the vote of the majority, but they are decided upon by the individual. And as a guarantee of responsibility for those decisions, he pledges all he has in the world, and even his life. The objection may be raised here that under such conditions it would be very difficult to find a man who would be ready to devote himself to so fateful a task. The answer to that objection is as follows. We thank God that the inner spirit of our German democracy will of itself prevent the chance careerist, who may be intellectually worthless and a moral twister, from coming by devious ways to a position in which he may govern his fellow citizens. The fear of undertaking such far-reaching responsibilities under German democracy will scare off the ignorant and the feckless. But should it happen that such a person might creep in surreptitiously, it will be easy enough to identify him and apostrophize him ruthlessly, somewhat thus: "Be off, you scoundrel! Don't soil these steps with your feet, because these are the steps that lead to the portals of the pantheon of history, and they are not meant for place-hunters, but for men of noble character." Such were the views I formed after 2 years of attendance at the sessions of the Viennese Parliament. Then I went there no more.